Our speaker today will be Dr. Newman. He will be speaking on the semantic problem and giving a proposal for handling both internal and external evidence. Before Dr. Newman begins speaking, let us have a word of prayer. We do thank you, our Heavenly Father, for those who do research in your word. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the clarity of it. Thank you, Heavenly Father, that we can gather here to learn more about a problem that has taxed the minds of many. We ask, Heavenly Father, that today that you would be with Dr. Newman as he presents his proposal. Give him clarity. Help us, Father, to understand. And we thank you for this time together, for we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
If you've read the abstract here, I won't need to read it, but maybe you haven't, I will. Both in liberal and conservative circles, the Gospels of Matthew and Mark are commonly viewed as being literally dependent on Mark. You know, start off great. Gospels of Matthew and Luke are commonly viewed as being literally dependent on Mark, even though this involves dismissing substantial traditions regarding their origin. On the other hand, it's difficult to see how these traditions square with the internal evidence on which the dominant two-document theory has been erected. Some suggestions for synthesis are here proposed. Questions regarding relationships between the canonical Gospels have been a concern since early in church history. Already in the second century, Tatian constructed a harmony which combined the four Gospels into a single narrative. In the fourth century, Eusebius drew up tables by which one could see if any given passage in the Gospels had parallels, which could then be quickly located. The first attempt to postulate a literary relationship between the three synoptic Gospels seems to have been that of Augustine, who suggested that Mark abridged Matthew and that Luke used both Matthew and Mark in composing his own Gospel. Let me stop for a second here and put up one overhead which shows four of your major documentary theories, and I'll say a little about all but one of them, really, off and on during the talk. The fall of the Roman Empire interrupted such studies, but they resumed after the Reformation with the production of several multi-column Gospel harmonies. Through the 19th century, many competing theories arose to explain the origin of the Gospels on the basis of similarities and differences in content, order, and wording. Some of these theories saw the Gospels as dependent entirely on oral sources, others entirely on written sources, others on almost any combination of the two. Some saw the earlier canonical Gospels as sources of the later ones. Such theories of successive dependence, that is, successive dependences, postulate no extra documents, just the Gospels, but one used another, and then the third used both. Some saw the canonical Gospels as sources of the later ones. Such theories of successive dependence had advocates for all possible sequences of the synoptic Gospels. Others saw the Gospels as dependent on one or more hypothetical written sources, which have not survived. The sources postulated range from a single written Gospel, on which all three synoptics depended, to a multitude of written fragments, some of which were used by all the canonical Gospels, others by three, two, or only one. By the beginning of this century, a consensus had developed in favor of the so-called two-document theory. In this view, the Gospels of Matthew and Luke were largely secondary accounts which relied heavily on their independent use of Mark and a hypothetical document usually called Q. This theory, occasionally elaborated by postulating additional non-extant documents, renounced the external evidence of tradition, especially that Matthew was the first Gospel to be written, in favor of internal evidence, which seemed to point to Mark as a more primitive account. Material common to both Matthew and Luke, but lacking in Mark, was thought to be evidence for Q, an early collection of Jesus' sayings. Some found external evidence for Q in the Logia, mentioned by Papias, whose statement, it was supposed, later church fathers had misunderstood as referring to the Gospel of Matthew. The two-document theory has dominated Protestant New Testament studies so far this century, both in liberal and, to a lesser extent, conservative circles. It's even penetrated Catholic circles, in spite of their greater regard for tradition. That Mark's Gospel was written first has often been considered one of the assured results of Gospel research. Recently, however, there has been renewed debate over the synoptic problem, in which both the priority of Mark and the existence of Q have frequently come under attack. Denial of Mark's priority has come from Basil Butler, Pearson Parker, William Farmer, Thomas Longstaff, Xavier Leon Dufour, Edward Sanders, A. Gabory, Robert Lindsay, David Dungan, Bernard Orchard. While about half of these are Catholics, many are liberal Protestants. Only Butler favors Augustine's form and successive dependence theory, Matthew first, and then Mark and Luke. Several, Farmer, Longstaff, Duncan, Orchard, favor Griesbach's form, Matthew first, then Luke, then Mark, which is experiencing strong revival at present. Generally, those attacking the priority of Mark also doubt the existence of Q, but there are also those who assert, who accept Mark's priority, but see no evidence for Q. These include Austin Farrer, A.W. Argyle, R.T. Simpson, Nigel Turner. It is doubtful that the two-document theory has been overthrown as yet, although George Buchanan seems to think so. It is certainly safe to say that no alternative is replaceable. In this paper, we'd like to examine both the internal evidence, or phenomena, of the synoptic problem, and the external evidence, largely the traditions about the Gospels given by the early church fathers. We will seek to evaluate various synoptic theories in the light of this evidence and make some proposals regarding a possible solution. The internal evidence. The internal evidence relating to the synoptic problem is complex and confusing. There's consequently great temptation to make oversimplified generalizations, construct one's theory, and then ignore or beat into submission any recalcitrant facts. Having said this, we have only space to sketch the data. Basically, this data can be divided into three categories, in each of which the synoptic gospels show both similarities and differences. These areas are content, both main incidents and details, order, both between and within incidents, where incident here I'm using for a whole scene, a pericope, pericope in the technical terminology, and wording, both vocabulary and particular grammatical forms. Alfred Well summarized the situation a century ago, quoting, "The phenomena presented will be much as follows. First, perhaps we shall have three, five, or more words identical, then as many wholly distinct, then two clauses or more expressing the same words but different order, then a clause contained in one or two but not in a third, then several words identical, then a clause not only wholly distinct but apparently inconsistent, and so forth, with recurrences of the same arbitrary and anomalous alterations, coincidences, and transpositions." Nor does this description apply to verbal and sentential arrangement only, but also with slight modifications that of larger portions of the narrative. Let's consider content first. In view of the fact that John speaks of the enormous number of events during Jesus' ministry, John 20:30 and 21:25, it is rather surprising how much overlap there is between the three synoptic gospels. Of course, we would expect overlap on the unique and crucial incidents of Jesus' ministry, such as his baptism and temptation, feeding of the 5,000, Peter's confession, the transfiguration, triumphal entry, trial, death, and resurrection. We'd also expect overlap in general features, such as Jesus' popularity, miraculous works, parabolic teaching, and the growing opposition from leaders. What is surprising is the synoptic's unanimous presentation of such specific miracles as the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, a certain leper, the paralytic, the man with a withered hand. Might stop for a second. These numbers here are numbers from a standard harmony, Huck's Harmony, and an English translation of it by Throckmorton. What is surprising is the synoptic's unanimous presentation of such specific miracles as the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, a certain leper, the paralytic, the man with a withered hand, and blind Bartimaeus, since Jesus must perform hundreds or thousands of healings during several years of ministry. All three Gospels also give the parable of the sower, with Jesus' reasons for teaching in parables and the interpretation of the sower, the parables of the wicked tenants and the fig tree budding, and the question about fasting, plucking grain on the Sabbath, the dispute about greatness, blessing of little children, the rich young ruler, and three predictions of Jesus' death, not to mention other incidents. There are, in addition, many more incidents duplicated in two of the three Gospels. This is in striking contrast with a much smaller overlap with John, which is more like what one would antecedently expect. This close similarity of content naturally suggests that the synoptic Gospels depend upon one of themselves or upon some common source, which Gospel or source made a definite selection from far more numerous materials. If we try to visualize this content overlap by the number of verses involved, the numbers are approximate since parallel passages don't necessarily have the same number of verses, we can present the situation in a diagram using three overlapping circles, each of which represents one gospel. Mathematicians will recognize this as a Venn diagram, I guess. I hope. The shaded section here on the right is material shared by all three synoptics, about 480 verses in each. In addition, there are roughly 300 verses shared by two of the three, most by Matthew and Luke. You see the 170 there in the little sort of triangle. Somewhat less by Matthew and Mark, 120, and little by Mark and Luke. Most notable is the fact that although Matthew and Luke have considerable material peculiar to each, Mark has very little, not found in one of the others. Some have interpreted this as evidence that Matthew and Luke use Mark, two-document theory, but others that Mark used Matthew and Luke, concentrating on their overlapping material, so-called Griesbach hypothesis. Here, Mark just picked out where Matthew and Luke had overlapping material. Both are consistent with his data, but neither is required by it. A discussion of details related to content is far beyond the scope of this paper. Only a careful examination of the Gospels in parallel columns will suffice to get a feel for the data. It ranges from striking similarity on some points, for example, the parentheses he said to the paralytic and let the reader understand, to sharp differences on others, for example, the number of demoniacs, blind men, crowing, and angels, various passages. The former cases exert pressure against oral source theories, where there's very close similarity, even in parentheses, and the latter against written source theories. Next, let us consider the evidence of order, both in main incidents, pericopes, and details within an incident. Several papers have dealt with this matter in recent years, by Perubchan, Honoré, Sanders, Tyson. The Synoptic Gospels agree in the general order of events in Jesus' ministry, that it began during John the Baptist's ministry, moved into Galilee, then to Judea, finally to Jerusalem, where Jesus suffered, died, and rose from the dead. But there's much more agreement than this. Let's look at the order in more detail. Nothing can be said about order where a gospel has incidents not mentioned in the others. The 480 verses where Matthew, Mark, and Luke all overlap, often called the triple tradition, consist of 72 pericopes. Perubchan notes that the 42 pericopes included in periods 1, 3, and 4, that is everything but the Galilean ministry, above, occur in the same order in all three gospels. The 30 pericopes of 2, the Galilean ministry, are also in basically the same order, though there are a few places where either Matthew or Luke individually departs from the order of Mark and the other synoptic. That is, Matthew departs from Mark and Luke, or Luke departs from Matthew and Mark. Using Robertson, I find 4 places where Matthew diverges and 3 where Luke does. It is noteworthy that at the level of pericopes, Matthew and Luke never agree against Mark in following a different order. This has usually been taken to indicate that Matthew and Luke independently used Mark, two-document theory. But according to Griesbach hypothesis, Mark got his order by alternately following Matthew and Luke, which turns out to work perfectly as well. See back another paper or two there. Second paragraph on page 5. Taking the Gospels two at a time, Tyson notes that there are no order divergences in pericope shared by Matthew and Mark alone, nor in those shared by Mark and Luke alone. By contrast, most of the material common to Matthew and Luke alone, so-called Q in the two-document theory, is located differently in each. This is rather hard on the so-called ur-gospel theory, in which each of the three gospels got its material independently from the same written source. Reread that. This is rather hard on the so-called ur-gospel theory, in which each of the three gospels got its material independently from the same written source. In this theory, one is hard-pressed to explain how it is that Matthew or Luke just happens to handle the material they used but Mark didn't in such a different way than the material they shared with Mark. Why the order differences? Those who think Luke used Matthew, or vice versa, for example, Augustine's and Griesbach's theory, versions of the successive dependence theory, are also in trouble here, as they must explain why one gospel relocated so much material already positioned in the other. The two-document theory, on the other hand, handles this phenomenon rather easily, since the pericopes shared by Matthew and Luke alone come from another source, Q. Because Q is mostly Jesus' discourse rather than narrative, it is claimed that Matthew and Luke had no information on where to locate it, so they independently fit it into their own narratives, thus producing the differences in order. However, this conclusion is not necessary to explain the material. Since Jesus was an itinerant teacher, it is likely that much of his discourse was given on several occasions. Matthew and Luke may well record similar statements made at different times. Turning to consider the matter of order within pericopes, there are many minor cases of divergence. Of more significant transpositions, Hawkins finds 23. 3 of Matthew versus Mark, 11 of Matthew versus Luke, none of Mark versus Luke, 6 of Matthew and Mark versus Luke, that is, 2 of them have one order and the other the other, 2 of Mark and Luke versus Matthew, and 1 of Matthew and Luke versus Mark. However, Sanders finds several more examples where Matthew and Luke agree against Mark. If valid, these are troublesome for the so-called two-document hypothesis, where it would seem to give evidence that Matthew and Luke are either familiar with each other or something of that sort, where in this theory, they're not familiar with each other, they're independently using Mark. Okay. Of Sanders' four clear cases, one is Hawkins above, and another is equally strong, both involving the order of materials within a pericope. The other two cases have nearly identical statements located in different pericopes. A proponent of the two-document theory would presumably explain these examples as similar material in Mark and Q, where both Matthew and Luke happen to follow Q. Sanders also gives three additional cases which seem quite weak to me. The argument from order has generally been one of the strongest for the two-document theory, yet Sanders notes many other cases where either passages are differently located in all three Gospels, or Mark differs from one Gospel when the other has no parallel, or Matthew and Luke put the same Q material in the same place relative to Mark. To the extent these examples are valid, the proponent of the two-document theory must either expand the size of Q until it begins to look like Matthew, moving towards Augustine's or Griesbach's theories, or concede that Luke and Matthew did not use their material independently, alleviating any need for Q. Let us now consider the verbal evidence related to the synoptic problem. According to Honoré, there are somewhat over 10,000 words in Mark and somewhat under 20,000 each in Matthew and Luke. All three Gospels overlap in passages containing about 8,000 words. If we define verbal agreement as the use of the same vocabulary word in the same grammatical form in a common passage, then the triple tradition has over 1,800 verbal agreements between all three Gospels. In addition, there are nearly 2,000 double verbal agreements between Matthew and Mark, over 600 between Matthew and Luke, and over 1,000 between Mark and Luke. The exact figures are included in the chart below. The Gospels, triple agreements, 1,852 words in this material, identical. And then double agreements between the various Gospels by pairs, total agreements, say in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, non-agreeing words in the same passage, total words, and percentage agreements, percentage exact agreements, notice, in these materials. Although we are only looking at the so-called triple tradition, similar material in all three synoptics, it is clear there is considerable verbal identity, at least in this part of the gospel material. It is certainly more than casual memory is likely to preserve. Therefore, oral source theories must postulate some enhancement, either through direct revelation, divine aid in recall, or memorization. On the other hand, this is pretty substantial divergence for copying, so written source theories must include substantial editing. Neither alternative can be ruled out by the verbal evidence, since ancient society depended much more on memory than we do, but it was also a common practice in writing histories to epitomize and edit existing written sources. Looking at the details above in this chart, notice that Mark has somewhat more agreements than either Matthew or Luke. Honoré does a statistical analysis of this phenomenon and of the order of incidence. He concludes that both favor Mark as the intermediary between Matthew and Luke, on the assumption that two Gospels use the other or others. In other words, assuming no other sources. Mark is intermediary in three schemes. First one, Matthew and Luke use Mark. Second one, Mark uses Matthew and Luke uses Mark, and perhaps Matthew as well. Third scheme, Mark uses Luke, and Matthew uses Mark, and perhaps Luke as well. Here, two and three have two alternatives, depending on whether or not there's also direct borrowing between the first and third gospel. Of these schemes, one is a two-document theory, with Q ignored, and two is Augustine's form of the successive dependence theory. Notice that Griesbach's form is definitely not favored by this analysis, although no assumptions were made against it in making the analysis. If we accept one on this basis, however, that is a two-document theory, the 637 cases where Matthew and Luke agree verbally against Mark must be explained, as according to the two-document theory, neither Matthew nor Luke is supposed to be dependent on the other. As the number of these agreements is more than one-third the number of triple agreements, it seems hazardous to explain them away, whether as places where Q and Mark overlap, but both Matthew and Luke prefer Q, or as cases where Matthew and Luke improve Mark's style in exactly the same way, or where later textual corruption has assimilated Luke, for instance, to Matthew. Honoré's further statistical studies, which favor the priority of Mark and the existence of Q, do not deal with this problem. We have now surveyed the more basic material which functions as internal evidence for the synoptic problem. We have not considered arguments that certain material in one gospel is more primitive than that in another. Such arguments frequently depend on debatable interpretations of the passages involved, and they always depend on definitions of development or primitiveness, such as increase in refinement, respect for Jesus, miraculous elements, or loss of picturesque details. Sanders has shown these tests to be unreliable in comparing the canonical Gospels, early materials, with apocryphons, late materials. Such tendencies that seem to be reliable by this comparison show no more evidence of primitivity in Mark than in Matthew. Before we move on to external evidence, let us review the status of various theories in the light of the internal evidence we've considered. The Ur-Gospel and Griesbach theories are able to explain the similar order in the Synoptics satisfactorily by means of borrowing. In the first, all follow the order of the hypothetical original Gospel pretty closely, though Mark's order is closest. The Griesbach theory sees Mark following the order of Matthew and Luke alternatively, therefore always agreeing with at least one of them. The Augustinian model seems more strained here. Basically, Mark follows Matthew with occasional divergence. Luke always prefers Mark's order to Matthew's, but does not always follow Mark himself. The most serious problem with the Ur-Gospel, Griesbach, and Augustinian views is the lack of agreement between Matthew and Luke in the order of what we will call Q material. This must have had some order in the original Gospel, whether the Ur-Gospel or Matthew. Why does Luke or Matthew depart from this order when they pretty well follow the order of their original otherwise? This problem seems to be nearly insurmountable at present. The burden of proof is certainly upon proponents of such views to come up with a reasonable explanation. The two-document theory has a natural explanation for the fact that Matthew and Luke never agree against Mark in order of pericopes. They have followed his order pretty closely. It also naturally explains a divergent order in Matthew and Luke, who disagree in inserting sayings into various contexts. It also naturally explains a divergence order in the Q material, though the shadow this casts on the historical reliability of Matthew and Luke, who disagree in inserting sayings into various contexts, should give evangelicals pause about adopting it wholeheartedly. Statistical study of the verbal similarities also favors this view, though not to the exclusion of the Augustinian. The main problems for the two-document theory involve details. Can we really get rid of 637 cases of verbal identity, where Matthew and Luke agree against Mark, by expanding Q, invoking stylistic improvements, or later textual assimilation? If we expand Q, it begins to pick up more narrative elements, which then undercut the usual explanation why the material was located differently by Matthew and Luke in the first place. If we allow much textual corruption, statistical arguments like Onorae's go down the drain, since many of his values on which he draws conclusions do not differ by much. The oral theory, or oral theories we could say, is quite flexible but also quite vague. It makes few predictions, but is not so easily attacked. Unless further developed, it does not offer an explanation why there should be so much overlap in the content of the synoptics. The verbal dissimilarities fit oral transmission well enough, but the verbal agreements and striking parallels in content require substantially memorized body of material. The striking divergences in detailed content and the lack of order in the Q material can be explained in various ways by oral theories, either consistent or inconsistent with the historical reliability of the material. In summary, on the basis of the internal evidence, the two-document theory seems to be significantly favored among the simpler written source theories. Oral source theories cannot be judged against it without further specification of the details. Let's turn now to external evidence related to the synoptic problem. The first matter to consider, though it does not necessarily bear on the question, is the authorship of the Gospels. The text of the Gospels, setting aside the titles for the moment, is anonymous in that none says, "I, Matthew, wrote this," or something of the sort. Yet the prologue of Luke suggests that its author was known to Theophilus, its recipient and patron. Luke, at least, was not anonymous at first. This is significant in view of the fact that early Christian tradition is unanimous in assigning these Gospels to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and that the earliest surviving manuscripts have titles also, all of which give the traditional authors only. This is most easily explained if, indeed, these were the authors and it was common knowledge in the early church. Otherwise, one must explain both the complete loss of the correct information and its complete replacement by a single set of spurious names, none of which are otherwise particularly prominent. If one accepts both the two-document theory and the traditional authors, for example, if one is a two-document evangelical, there is the anomalous situation that Matthew, an apostle and eyewitness, copied a substantial fraction of his work from Mark, a mere assistant with little first-hand knowledge of Jesus' ministry. This is not impossible, but it certainly requires special explanation. Let us look next at the order in which the Gospels were written. Tradition definitely favors Matthew's priority over Mark's. It is true that our earliest witness, Papias, in the few fragments presently known from his writings, does not make any explicit statements about his order. Yet his remark about Matthew's logia, then Matthew wrote the oracles, ta logia, in the Hebrew dialect, but everyone interpreted them as he was able. Yet his remark about Matthew's logia rather suggests that for some time nothing else was available. If Papias was referring to Matthew's gospel, he at least hints that it was first. Irenaeus, who studied with Polycarp, a student of the Apostle John, is quite explicit in saying that Mark wrote after Matthew. Quotation. Now, Matthew published a book of the gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect, while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding a church. After their departure, the Greek there is exodus, Mark, the disciple interpreter of Peter, also handed down to us in writing the things preached by Peter. Clement of Alexandria, a younger contemporary of Irenaeus, repeats a tradition of the early presbyters that the gospels which contain the genealogies, that is Matthew and Luke, were written first. Neither Irenaeus nor Clement seem to depend directly on Papias, unless one has decided that Papias must be the sole source of all tradition on Matthew and Mark. Later testimony by Origen, Eusebius, and Jerome also puts Matthew first, though these are writing long after the events and probably depend on earlier writers. There is disagreement on the relative order of Mark and Luke in tradition. Clement explicitly puts Mark third, but Origen puts him second and Luke third. Earlier sources are not decisive. The fragments of Papias do not mention Luke. Irenaeus gives the Gospels in the order Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, but Luke alone lacks a chronological connector. I'll give you this scattered quotation. It's all out of one passage, but with breaks. Now, Matthew published while Peter and Paul were preaching gospel in Rome. After their departure, Mark handed down the things preached by Peter. Luke also, the follower of Paul, put down in the book the gospel preached by that one. Afterwards, John. So you notice Luke is the only one there. Doesn't say it's after Mark necessarily, though the order given is after Mark. Some indirect information relevant to this question can be extracted from the New Testament and the Church Fathers. Taking Irenaeus' statement that Mark was written after the exodus of Peter and Paul to mean after their departure from Rome rather than after their death, or it could mean either, then his testimony is consistent with Clement's, where Peter is seen reacting to Mark's gospel after its writing. This would date Mark in the mid-60s, after Paul leaves Rome, about 63, but before Peter and Paul are martyred under Nero, somewhere in the period 64 to 68. Luke, however, was written before Acts. Compare the prologues of Luke and Acts. And Acts is most naturally dated before the death of Paul or the outbreak of the Roman persecution, around 64 AD. Thus it appears that Luke precedes Mark, being written in the early 60s while Paul was in Rome, or perhaps even during the 2 years Luke was in Palestine and Paul was in prison in Caesarea. The traditional evidence thus gives the order Matthew, Mark, Luke, or Matthew, Luke, Mark, which fit either the Augustinian or Griesbach models, but not the two-document theory. Irenaeus' testimony to the date of Matthew is a problem, though, as he puts it in the early 60s, too, while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding the church. This would crowd the writing of all three synoptics into just a few years, which seems to conflict with Papias' picture of some time during which only Matthew was available. Proponents of a two-document theory who don't reject Papias altogether have often sought to solve these problems by postulating that Papias is not referring to our canonical Matthew at all, but to Q. That's looking back on page 8, the quotation right near the bottom there. This allows the order Q, Mark, Matthew, Luke, or Q, Mark, Luke, Matthew, but only at the price of rejecting the testimony of Irenaeus and Clement. They are dismissed as dependent on that of Papias alone and misunderstanding him. This is a rather precarious position, as Irenaeus is more likely to have gotten his information from Polycarp than Papias, since Polycarp was his teacher, and Clement claims to depend on several early presbyters. In addition, the common claim that Papias' term logia better describes a saying source like Q than a gospel like Matthew, term logia means something like oracles, ignores Papias' own usage. Logia are what Papias himself is expounding. His title of his work is Exposition of the Oracles of the Lord, yet he includes Jesus' action as well as his words, from what we can tell with a few scattered fragments. He applies the term in speaking of Mark, which involves, as he says, things either said or done by the Lord. We should consider two other significant points in the tradition on the Synoptic Gospels: the language of Matthew and the connection of Mark with Peter. The citations of Papias and Irenaeus above sufficiently illustrate the former, which is a regular feature of the tradition. The natural understanding is that Matthew wrote in Aramaic or Hebrew. The suggestion that this refers to a Hebraistic form of Greek seems unlikely. It assumes Papias is the sole source, and again, misunderstood. It doesn't fit very well with Papias' remark that everyone interpreted them as he was able. On the other hand, the extant Greek text of Matthew is not generally considered to be translation Greek, the kind of Greek seen in the Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. The connection between Mark's gospel and Peter is seen in Papias. And this the presbyter used to say. Mark, indeed, since he was the interpreter of Peter, wrote accurately but not in order the things either said or done by the Lord as much as he remembered. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterwards, as I've said, Peter, who fitted his discourses to the needs, but not as if making a narrative of the Lord's oracles. Consequently, Mark, writing some things just as he remembered, erred in nothing, for his careful one thing, not to omit any of the things he had heard or to falsify anything in them. That Mark's gospel is Peter's preaching is quite clear, in spite of obscurities regarding some other matters. Justin Martyr, about 150, in referring to material which occurs only in Mark, appears to speak of Peter's memoirs, though possibly he means Christ's memoirs. Irenaeus definitely connects Mark's gospel of Peter, as noted above. Clement's testimony should also be noted, quoting, "The gospel according to Mark had this occasion. When Peter had preached the word publicly in Rome and declared the gospel by the Spirit, those who were present, there were many, besought Mark, since he had followed him for a long time and remembered the things that had been spoken, to write out the things that had been said. And when he had done this, he gave the gospel to those who had asked him. When Peter learned of it later, he neither obstructed nor encouraged it." To summarize external evidence relevant is not the problem, we note that a substantial tradition indicates that all three gospels were written no later than the 60s, that Matthew was written first, apparently in Aramaic or Hebrew, that Mark or Luke was second, and that Mark preserves the testimony of Peter. This evidence is unfavorable to the Ur-Gospel theory, unless the original gospel is taken to be the Semitic form of Matthew. It gives a very different order for the writing of the gospels than does the two-document theory. The orders given fit either the Augustinian or Griesbach models, but tradition does not have Mark using either of the other written gospels as these theories do. Some suggestions for synthesis. The date of the synoptic problem presents a puzzle. Internal evidence generally favors the two-document theory, or at least Markan priority. External evidence favors Matthean priority. How is this to be resolved? It has been common practice to dismiss the external evidence, since the Church Fathers can no longer be cross-examined, while we can still examine all of the internal evidence. This is true, but it should be balanced by the observation that the interpretation of internal evidence can be rather subjective, and it doesn't exactly fit any of the simple documentary theories anyway. Suppose that, instead of ignoring the external evidence and constructing the simplest model that almost fits the internal data, we try to give both fair shake. Our biggest problem is the question of the relative priority of Matthew and Mark. Here, let us note that the internal evidence and the external evidence are not necessarily looking at the same thing. Internal evidence suggests that the content of Mark is generally prior to Matthew. External evidence suggests that the writing of Matthew is prior to Mark. Tradition tells us that Mark preserves the preaching of Peter. The New Testament indicates, without papal overtones, the preeminence of Peter among the apostles, especially in his activity as principal spokesman during those early years when all the apostles remained together. If we suppose that Peter, or the apostles in concert, made a selection of the materials from the life of Christ to form their basic gospel presentation, then the common part of the synoptics may be explained as the apostolic testimony. This would be an oral gospel very much like Mark, though perhaps lacking certain features of Peter's vivid personality, a sort of proto-Mark. Matthew would naturally use this oral gospel in composing a written one, though he is supplemented with some of the detailed teaching of Jesus, as well as information on his birth. Luke, too, would use the apostolic testimony, so he claims, Luke 1:2, but he has done independent research to supplement it, Luke 1:3. Much of the verbal similarity shared by Matthew and Luke, but not Mark, is in this view due to repetition in Jesus' teaching, not guesswork in dividing up a saying source Q. The relative shortness of Mark compared with Matthew and Luke is then seen as a reflection of Peter's own action-oriented personality. His additions to the apostolic testimony were largely matters of color rather than additional incidents or discourses. This view naturally explains how sometimes Matthew, and even Luke, will seem more primitive since they do not depend on our written Mark. how they may on occasion agree against Mark in wording or order, though they generally seem to follow him. The rougher style of Mark is explained by its being a transcript of oral presentation rather than a literary work. The fine Hebrew poetic structure seen regularly in Matthew is then the creation of Jesus rather than of some unknown Semitic genius in the early church. Two problems come to mind with this proposal. The first is the tradition of an Aramaic or Hebrew Matthew. Could the synoptics be as close together verbally as they are if Matthew was not originally in Greek? Could our present Matthew be a translation of a Semitic original? If there was such a document, why would it disappear? We have only room to sketch an answer to each of these. In reverse order, any document will tend to disappear if it is preserved only by copying and there is no one who knows its language that is interested in copying it. The original Aramaic of Josephus has disappeared to this day. The Hebrew Bible disappeared from Christian circles and the Greek Bible from Western Europe, only to be recovered in modern times because there were other groups who continued to copy them. Our present Matthew could easily be a translation if the translation technique was more like that used on Josephus' works, translated by the author, than that used by the translators of the Septuagint. Lastly, if the apostolic testimony existed in both a Greek and Semitic oral form, as the church was bilingual from the start, then Matthew may have used the Greek form in preparing his later Greek version of the Gospel. The other problem is Irenaeus' dating of the Gospel of Matthew in the 60s. Here I would suggest that perhaps Irenaeus confused two traditions, putting the fact of its original Semitic form together with the date of its later publication in Greek. I propose an early date for the Semitic Matthew, 40s or 50s, followed by Luke in the late 50s or early 60s, then by Greek Matthew while Peter and Paul were preaching in Rome, and finally by Mark in the mid-60s. This proposal, I think, does reasonable justice to both internal and external evidence, though I stand ready to be corrected. It is also consistent with the New Testament picture of the history and character of the apostolic period and with the biblical doctrine of the inerrancy of Scripture. Okay, that's the paper, and I'll be glad to try and answer questions or explain things. Yes, sir.
You're suggesting then that presumably Luke would have translated the Semitic Matthew, to get his agreements with Matthew, and then Matthew later translated his own Semitic Matthew from his Greek version.
Actually, what I would suggest is that there exists an oral apostolic testimony which occurred in both a Semitic and a Greek version, and I say Semitic because I don't know whether it's Hebrew or Aramaic, version that carries down all the way to Mark and on beyond. Okay, and that was the regular preaching material, the regular teaching material used by the apostles. And that was available in both Greek and Hebrew, or Greek and Semitic language, let's say, through that period. That Luke would presumably use a Greek form of it. We don't know, but probably Luke did not know Semitic language. It's, of course, conceivable if he is, as tradition says, a native of Antioch, that he may have known Syriac, may have known Aramaic. So, hard to say. My guess would be that he took the oral apostolic testimony that was available at that time, probably by questioning apostles and getting the material, and then did his own research on other individuals and picked up incidents here and there, which we don't see in the other Gospels, about when somebody said something or anything. Right. So I would have Luke not doing any translation himself. Matthew having an originally Semitic form, taken directly from the Semitic apostolic testimony and presumably some of his own personal material, which he then later translated into Greek and presumably used, he is an apostle after all, so he would have the apostolic testimony memorized in some form, used probably the Greek form later in doing this, rather than this just being a straight translation. Wouldn't want to press that. But, yeah, further on that.
So you what, then sort of have a dotted line that would go from the apostolic testimony over to its Greek Matthew?
Yeah, should, I guess, right. The complication of drawing arrows there is that Matthew himself is presumably one who's got this in his mind. So the question of an arrow here and an arrow there is somewhat complicated. But, yeah, for clarification, probably there should be an arrow like these two ought to come off here and go down to the Greek Matthew, suggesting that he used the Greek form for later time. I think that's the simplest way to avoid the complication. That he should happen to translate his Semitic into a Greek and still have all his verbal identity with both Mark and Luke.
that you would see there.
Neil.
Okay, what you're saying then is that Matthew took the oral apostolic testimony, added things he remembered, and came up with this gospel.
Okay.
Luke came up with the oral apostolic testimony plus research, came up with his. Mark just took the straight apostolic testimony.
Okay. Mark, as the tradition says, wrote down what Peter was preaching. So he, by the tradition, does not do a lot of research on his own. He really writes down that material. So that would be their standard teaching material. Now, by saying what Matthew remembered, I'm not saying everything Matthew remembered, but Matthew selected out some other materials in addition to the standard presentation material to add to his gospel.
But doesn't that still leave the problem of where Matthew and Luke are different?
Where Matthew and Luke are different. No, because basically all three of these depend on the strand, the testimony, which is an oral form. And the way Peter presents it, he may use chi's instead of des, or things of that variety. In other words, he may have stylistic differences about his presentation. But basically what you're doing is you're making something like an Ur gospel construction, except that this is oral. And therefore, the oral accounts for some of the divergences in wording. The different apostles would word things somewhat differently. Yes?
Could you answer somewhere again here, maybe I missed it, the traditional ordering of Matthew, Mark, Luke?
Yes, this is a little bit different. Basically, what I'm saying here is that the explicit traditional statements we've got seems to favor Luke being earlier than Mark. In other words, when we talk about the traditional order, meaning the order they occur in manuscripts, we don't know for a fact that that was intended to be a chronological order. We do know that Clement seems to understand it as a chronological order. But Irenaeus doesn't say what the order of Matthew and Luke relative to each other are, though it could be read as saying that Matthew's prior, Mark is prior. And Clement explicitly says that the Gospels with the genealogies were written first, which would put Luke ahead of Mark, since Mark doesn't have a genealogy and Luke does. Okay, so I think the internal suggestions from the relative dates of Acts and Luke also suggest that Luke is earlier than the 60s, or at least very early in the 60s. So again, I think it goes that way. Really, the only place I would go against an explicit, there's a place where there's a disagreement in a tradition on the relative order of Luke and Mark, so I made a selection of one of them. The only place I've gone against the tradition on this material is in saying that I think maybe Irenaeus has combined a statement about Semitic Matthew with a statement about Greek Matthew. And the date is a Greek Matthew date, but the statement that there was a Semitic Matthew is the other. Further questions? Yes, Tom?
Did you mean to indicate that Mark was necessarily later than the Greek Matthew?
No, that wouldn't necessarily... the reason I put that way was following Irenaeus' statement. Matthew was published while Peter and Paul were preaching the gospel in Rome and founding a church. After their departure, Mark also handed down to us in writing the things written by Peter.
That could be
the Semitic gospel in that case, okay. But on my interpretation here, which goes beyond the material, I suggested that the date information of Irenaeus might be about the Greek, which would then put ahead of Mark and move the Semitic gospel back to give it some time to fit Papias' statement. Everyone interpreted as they were able. You kind of get the idea there was a period when there was a written Semitic gospel available, but a lot of people didn't know Semitic language and had to ask other people to interpret it or make a stab at interpreting or something. And so this gives you perhaps a decade or so in which there might be a written Semitic gospel with nothing else until Luke writes. Now, the spacing here is not to be pressed, but the order here I did intend to represent what seemed to be a chronological order.
And then when you say oral apostolic testimony, that would include both Matthew and Peter.
That would include Matthew, Peter, John. It would include the apostles in general, I would think. That
actually, your line of apostolic testimony would go to Semitic Matthew as well as to Mark, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. I have kind of an arrow out there. Maybe those arrows aren't totally satisfactory. Maybe they should have been dotted or bigger or something. I haven't thought through exactly how to draw it so it will convey as clearly as it might. The point there. And here not particularly saying that any of these are any more directly connected to it, except that one might well suggest that Mark is perhaps a very little in addition to the apostolic testimony, whereas the others have some additional material that may not have been regularly proclaimed, though that's not easy to answer. It's, of course, possible. In fact, it's certain that all of them have highly abridged what actually happened, just to select a few things. But if you're attempting to explain why they all have a fairly similar abridgment in one line,
yes. Are you aware of studies done on the nature of oral tradition and memorizing facts and that kind of thing?
Yes. A Swedish school of New Testament scholars has done a good deal of work on that. It's mentioned back in the back of the paper there under the footnote where I make a remark about oral. Footnote 34. Neither alternative can be ruled out by verbal evidence, since ancient society depended much more on memory than we do. If you look back at 34 in the back, see especially Harold Riesenfeld, The Gospel Tradition, and Werner Gerhardsen, and Memory and Manuscript. This Memory and Manuscript is a very interesting work. We've got a couple copies in the library, in fact. We basically sketch out for you the place of memory in rabbinic teaching and the place of memory in Greek philosophical teaching. Very high compared with what we would normally think. That is, the standard teaching method was the students were expected to memorize the words of their teachers, and the teacher repeated proverbial type statements almost until they memorize them, and they recite them back to him until they build up quite a large supply of this very tightly memorized material. I think perhaps he may go too far, Gerhardsen may go too far in suggesting that Jesus worked exactly that way, although I'm not sure we can rule that out, that he may, after all, we don't have an hour session of him recorded somewhere in the Gospel of what he was doing. Even for something like the Sermon on the Mount, you probably got something short of what he was doing. Well, he may have sat down with them and had them memorize things. But even if not that, if you get a group of people together here who say, okay, well, now we're going to present what Jesus did, what things ought we to pick out? And they pick out certain things. And then they say, well, how ought we to say them to best convey the importance of it and its relation and such? And so you construct basically anecdotes of each of these things Jesus did. And after you've worked them up for a year or so, the apostles are together for several years, you've developed what you might say is an optimum kind of way of saying it. And then as those are carried down traditionally, they will tend to be, I think, memorized. If you've ever listened to a preacher who's an itinerant preacher, doesn't have to have three new sermons every week, but is able to get by with several, just a few sermons, and he gives them over and over and over and over, and if you've heard him preach the same sermon three or four times, all itinerant preachers have heard themselves preach over three or four times, if you haven't heard other people do it, you get very similar wording in a lot of them. I'll say this anecdote about Dr. McCrae. I know some of the older members of the faculty can hear from the introduction of one of his anecdotes which story is coming. They know how it gets started, you see, and able to tell you how it's going to go thereafter. I haven't quite got that experience yet, but I think we see that sort of thing. And here we're dealing, of course, not with just our own memories about some events in the past, but our memories about how God himself became man and came down for our redemption. Very crucial matters of utmost importance by people who lived for several years with Jesus and had these things. So I don't think we necessarily have to suppose that Jesus had memory work sessions with the people, with the disciples, though he might have. But just their being immersed in this, and then they're correcting each other and repeating this material for a couple years together, solidified it into a block of material which then would keep its form very definitely for years and years as they repeated it independently. Yeah, but Gerhardsen would be an excellent work to see what material exists from antiquity on that subject.
Neil, did you have a question?
Yeah, you did mention the under memory about the possibility of being divinely reminded, shall we say, that passage in John, but you didn't treat on it at all.
Yeah, because I don't know how much of a fraction that would be significant in the matter, nor what it means by the Holy Spirit will bring these to your memory. Does it mean he will do it immediately so that something just comes in your memory? Or does it mean by talking with one another and reminiscing over these things, you will begin to remind of the thing and put together things that allow you to reconstruct what happened? A very important feature, even in research today, I think about the return of the astronauts from the moon, that when they landed, they were always debriefed, which means a number of scientists got around, stood around them asking them questions for two or three days, with sleep and such, but with two or three days, trying to prime out of their memory and jog out of their memory what things they had noticed, but perhaps not had not made much of, and gradually then this this work itself out. Well, the same way, three or four people that have seen an incident, if they get together and talk about it, they can bring to the memory of each other things that they might not remember otherwise. So the biblical passage is definitely there and is to be included, but how it's to be included, whether it means supernatural, unrelated to means, or whether it means through means or not, I don't know.
But it does ensure the infallibility thereof.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Other questions? Well, let's thank Dr. Newman for the presentation.